So today we're up to the story of Hanukkah in our journey from the Second Temple period to the Second Millennium. Just a brief, I guess, structure of the dates in Jewish history around this time. Again, around 516 BCE, the Second Beis Hamikdash is rebuilt. Alexander the Great conquers Eretz Yisrael about 332 BCE, and Alexander the Great dies in 323 BCE, and from about 300 or so to about 200, the Ptolemaic, the southern, the Egyptian successors to Alexander, that empire controls Eretz Yisrael. And in about the year 200 BCE, the Seleucid, the Syrian successors of Alexander the Great conquer Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is in the middle between Egypt and Syria. So it's a very strategic location. So again, from about 300 to 200 BCE, it's controlled by the Egyptians, the Ptolemaic Empire. And then from around the year 200 BCE, it's controlled by the Seleucids. And the truth is, initially, they were good to the Jews. Antiochus III, who conquered Eretz Yisrael. This is not Antiochus from the Hanukkah story. He exempted the Jewish population from taxation for 3 years, and afterwards their taxes were reduced even from normal taxation that other subject nations had to pay. Members of the Gerusia, the Sanhedrin, and the Kohanim were given complete exemption from taxes. There were good relations with one of Antiochus's sons, Seleucus IV, who took over for Antiochus III after he died in 187 BCE. However, problems began when Antiochus needed money. Antiochus was defeated by the Romans in 188 BCE. He signed a peace treaty, which placed a very heavy financial burden on the Seleucid kingdom to pay the victorious Roman Republic. So now, the kings of the Seleucid dynasty found themselves compelled to raise money from every source. And a good source to raise money was the various temples, including the Beis Hamikdash. So originally, let's say when Seleucus IV, he attempted to appropriate money from the treasury of the Beis Hamikdash. His goal was not to offend the Jewish religion. He acted out of simple financial considerations. However, this was regarded by many as the first stage in the clash between the Jews and the Seleucid kingdom. Now, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story, takes over in 175 BCE. And during the first 7 years of his rule, he focused on securing the southern border of his kingdom from the Ptolemaic empire in Egypt. So Judea was a very important center to him. His father's defeat at the hands of the Roman had deprived his kingdoms of much of its manpower. So Antiochus sought to fill the gap from the resources that existed within the kingdom and by accelerating the Hellenization of the lands under his rule. And he thought that if he Hellenizes his subject populations, then they would become loyal supporters of his kingdom. And so what he does specifically in Judea is that he deposes Onias III, the Kohen Gadol, and he replaces him with his brother Jason. Jason had Hellenizing tendencies, and he promised to raise more taxes for the king. Jason attempted to transform Jerusalem into a polis, a Greek ancient city-state named Antiochia, by establishing institutions characteristic of the Greek ancient city-state, such as the gymnasium used for military training, which soon superseded the Beis Hamikdash as the focus of social life to the dismay of those loyal to the Jewish tradition. In the book of Maccabees, in the second book of Maccabees, chapter 4, it states that when Seleucus died, Antiochus, who was called Epiphanes, succeeded to the kingdom. Jason, the brother of Onias, obtained the high priesthood by corruption, promising the king at an interview 360 talents of silver and from another source of revenue, 80 talents. An important side point is that the Kohanim Gedolim during the time of the Second Beis Hamikdash weren't always the best, weren't always the most faithful to tradition. We see here that Jason acquires it from by corruption. Many of us are familiar with the Mishnah in the first chapter in Yoma, where the Kohen Gadol is forced to swear to the elders that he will faithfully follow the Yom Kippur service when he enters into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur. And we have to ask, why? How? What's the concern? He's the Kohen Gadol. And as we know, it's not so certain that the Kohen Gadol would follow and would be faithful to the traditional approach of how one should act in the halachos of how one should act in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, because many of the Kohanim Gedolim may not have followed the traditions that were eventually recorded in the Mishnah. And the early precedent for not such great Kohanim Gedolim being the spiritual leaders or the religious leaders is this, where Jason, the brother of Onias, obtains the high priesthood by corruption. And the Book of Maccabees continues and states, in addition to this, he promised to pay 150 more if permission were given to establish by his authority a gymnasium and a body of youth for it, and to enroll the men of Jerusalem as the citizens of Antioch. He wants to start this gymnasium. So then Jason can shift the Jewish people over to the Greek way of life. And in this passage, it states, there was such an extreme of Hellenization and an increase in the adoption of foreign ways because of the surpassing wickedness of Jason, who was ungodly and no high priest, that the priests were no longer intent upon their service at the altar, despising the sanctuary and neglecting the sacrifices. They hastened to take part in the unlawful proceedings in the wrestling arena after the call to the discus, disdaining the honors prized by their fathers and putting the highest value upon Greek forms of prestige. We see that the Kohanim are abandoning their duties in the Beis HaMikdash to attend competitions in the gymnasium. Soon, though, Antiochus deposed Jason and appointed Menelaus in his stead in 171 BCE. Now, Menelaus did not even belong to the family of Kohanim Gedolim, but he raised a lot of money for the king by cruelly extorting the people of Judea and robbing the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohen Gadol, who had been originally the representative of the Jewish nation and its interests, now became the representative of the crown in Judea. Antiochus is governor in Jerusalem and his main partner in carrying out his Judean policy. Meanwhile, the Ptolemaic kingdom had declared war on Antiochus in order to recover southern Syria and Eretz Yisrael, and Antiochus fought back and attacked Egypt. In 169 BCE, Antiochus, with the help of Menelaus, plundered the treasures of the Beis HaMikdash on the way back from his first invasion from Egypt. A year later, during his last expedition to the Nile Valley, rumors of Antiochus's death spread in Judea, so Jason returned to Jerusalem and seized power. However, Antiochus soon returned from Egypt after having been stopped from conquering Alexandria by the Romans. He captured the city and punished its inhabitants. And to ensure his future control of Jerusalem, he stationed in its citadel, the Acra, non-Jewish settlers who were joined by extreme Hellenists from Menelaus's party. And this resulted in non-Jewish and Hellenistic elements controlling the city. In 167 BCE, Antiochus totally prohibited the observance of the mitzvos of the Jewish religion, and any Jew found observing Shabbos or circumcising his son was put to death. He also forced upon the Jewish people idolatrous rites that prohibited food, chiefly the eating of non-kosher, like pig. The Mikdash was desecrated and henceforth called after the Olympian Zeus. This was the first instance of religious persecution in Jewish history. Now, what's fascinating is that polytheism is generally regarded as naturally tolerant. You believe in many different gods, so I believe in my God, you can believe in your God. And the truth is, Antiochus did not persecute other religious minorities. Apparently, the long-lasting tension in Judea made the king realize that the Jewish religion, with its militant monotheism, lay behind the stubborn resistance of the Jews to the innovations that he wished to introduce in their country, and that this resistance endangered the security of his southern border. It's also possible that his personality was strongly repelled by the Jewish religion, which contradicted his entire outlook on life. Now, contrary to Antiochus' expectations, the majority of the nation remained faithful to its religion, and members of its various classes showed a readiness to undergo martyrdom. It was significant because this story of Hanukkah and this martyrdom was used as a symbol for martyrdom and even suicide at times during the Crusades of the medieval period of history. Ezra HaSofer and his followers did a wonderful job. The unlimited devotion of the Jewish masses to their religion was deep-rooted. And Antiochus did not realize that Menelaus had no real foothold amongst the people. And this whole Hanukkah story also brought about eschatological expectations, i.e., a growing belief that a period of unprecedented suffering was approaching, heralding the downfall of the evil kingdom and the fulfillment of the visions of the end of days. Now, let's just take a step back for a moment and talk a bit about Greek thought. There were three, I guess, major Greek philosophers who lived in the aggregate between 469 BCE and 322 BCE, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And again, Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great. So during this time period, the beginning of the Second Temple period, you have these philosophers. And they generally talked about virtues. Socrates, who lived from 469 to 399 BCE, he tried to find the definition of virtues, such as courage and justice. And he was executed for corrupting the young of Athens, the youth of Athens, for disbelieving in the gods. However, he became a martyr, and many of his disciples devoted themselves to the investigation of good and virtue. Plato, he lived from 428 to 348 BCE. He also sought to study virtue and what is good, and so did his disciple Aristotle, who was the teacher of Alexander the Great. And the aim was Aristotle was to recognize the purpose of all things. And the truth is, a lot of Spanish Jewish thinkers base some of their philosophy on Greek thought. For example, the Rambam. Therefore, Hellenism was not necessarily foreign to Judaism. However, from the time of Ezra, in the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash, there was a rigorizing tendency in the daily life of the Jew when the Jews internalized the notion that Judaism should be a part of every aspect of their daily life. Until the Hellenists arrived, the Jews considered themselves superior to the other neighboring pagans, sensing that their culture was far superior and more developed than the pagan culture. When the Hellenists arrived, bringing with them their culture, different groups of Jews reacted in different ways. So, for example, some Jews were isolationists, and they retreated into the wilderness or the desert and were otherworldly. They didn't want to do anything. They didn't want to have anything to do with the material world. An example of this was the Qumran community, and we learned a lot about them from the Dead Sea Scrolls. There were other groups that they welcomed Greek culture. In Judea, as in other Greek conquests, the upper classes, the rich, the senior priests or the senior Kohanim were most tempted by Hellenism in order to gain favor with their new rulers and to retain first-class citizenship. And this is perhaps why, according to some scholars, Shimon HaTzadik, he was the last of the Ashkenazi Gdola, transformed the nature of the leadership of the Jewish people from the Ashkenazi Gdola, which was comprised only of the upper class, to the what was to be called eventually the Sanhedrin, which was comprised of both the upper and the lower class. And the reason for this is that he saw that the upper class was becoming much more Hellenized, and therefore he wanted to include in the spiritual leadership of the Jewish people great leaders from the lower middle classes. Now, so these were two different groups, the Qumran, the otherworldly isolationists, and the Hellenizers. But there was a third moderate group, which was composed of a group of pious Jews who believed in the tradition of Ezra, who only cared to practice their religion in peace and did not care about Jewish sovereignty. And generally speaking, it's important to know what's at stake in any given part of history. Are you interested in merely freedom of religion or some form of self-government or full sovereignty? Greek and Jewish culture may have been able to coexist, except for the fact that there were more radical elements of Hellenism who wanted to merge universalist Greek culture with Jewish universal monotheism. They reread historical scriptures as being far more universalistic to reduce it to its ethical core. They did not want to abolish the law completely, the Torah completely, but they wanted to purge it of those elements which forbade participation in Greek culture, for example, the ban on nudity, which kept pious Jews out of the gymnasium and the stadium. They wanted a marriage between the Greek polis and the Jewish moral God. And this reminds me a little bit of what the Reform movement tried to do in the beginning of the movement, the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, where they saw that there were many Jews who were converting, but they wanted to create a fusion between Judaism and outside culture, and they wanted Jews to be accepted by the outside secular culture. And so they wanted to purge the Torah of what they felt were more archaic ritual elements of the Torah, and to leave those elements which were consistent with the zeitgeist, with outside culture. And I think similarly, many of the Hellenists wanted to do this as well. However, there is an irreconcilability between Jewish religion and Greek culture. Polytheism is irreconcilable with monotheism. Greek culture places a limited power on certain gods, in contrast to the limitless power of Hashem, of God. Greeks constantly elevated the human and lowered the divine. To them, gods were not much more than revered and successful ancestors. Most men sprang from gods according to Greek thought. Therefore, it was not such a great step to deify a monarch. And obviously, the Jews have a totally different perspective on God. God is beyond time and beyond space. It is unclear whether Jews would have rejected Hellenism if it did not lead to religious persecution. I heard a beautiful pshat, a beautiful explanation when we say the Al-Hanisim, and we thank God not just for the miracles, and not just for the redemption, and not just for the strength, the gvuros, but we thank God for the milchamos, for the wars. Why do we thank Hashem for the wars? Because it could be that had there not been a war, had there not been an outright ban on Judaism, which led to a war, we might have completely assimilated. In any case, the powerful movement of resistance against the Syrian authorities emerged, led by the Hashmonaim, a priestly family, family of Kohanim, living in Modi'in in the Lud district, and headed by a Kohen named Matisyahu. Although there were Jews outside the borders of the Seleucid kingdom, remember the Seleucid kingdom was the kingdom of Syria and Eretz Yisrael, but there were Jews living in Egypt at that time who weren't part of this kingdom. The truth is, most of the Jews lived within the borders of the Seleucid kingdom, and it's doubtful whether those Jews outside the Seleucid kingdom would have survived if Judaism had died within its borders. The revolt obviously was successful. Why was it successful? So number one, there was boundless loyalty of the Jewish masses to their religion. Torah had become part of everyday life and for tens of thousands of farmers in Judea, and it was regarded as an essential element in their existence. Again, we cannot downplay the great work that Ezra HaSofer did in ensuring that his students and their students and their students and their students, so on and so forth, would regard how important Judaism is to their very existence. Extreme Hellenists opposed the revolt, but moderate Hellenists backed the leaders of the revolt at the decisive moment of the war and exerted their influence in establishing foreign contacts. There was a lot of manpower available to the Hashmonaim, and the peasantry made excellent soldiers. At this time, the Seleucid force totaled 70,000 men, but part of the royal army was engaged in campaigns and defensive measures in the eastern part of their empire. In 166 BCE, the first clash began when the king's forces came to Modi'in, and the famous, in the Book of Maccabees, which describes the events around that time, Matisyahu said, "If all the nations that are in the king's dominions obey him, and by forsaking every one of them the worship of their fathers have chosen for themselves to follow his commandments, yet will I and my sons and my brethren walk in the covenant of our fathers. Heaven forbid that we should forsake the law and the ordinances." One of the Jews who obeyed the royal command and approached the pagan altar to offer this pagan sacrifice was killed by Matisyahu. After this incident, Matisyahu could no longer stay in Modi'in, so he and his supporters hid in the hills, where they were joined by others who shared similar views. Soon Matisyahu became the leader of this group, and they were instrumental in adopting several important decisions that were accepted by all, and most notably, the notion that one was permitted to take arms on Shabbos to repulse attacks. In the Book of Maccabees, in the first Book of Maccabees, in chapter 2, so it describes how there were groups of Jews that hid in the wilderness, and the enemy waited until Shabbos to attack them. And the Jews would not fight back because it was Shabbos. Now we know that the halacha is that you're allowed to set aside Shabbos in order to save your life. But at this time, it seems that that this was not a settled halacha, that everyone agreed to this. That halacha that we find in the Gemara, that you can set aside Shabbos, you can set for to save a life. So this was established much later on in Jewish history in the town of Lud. But it seems that from the Book of Maccabees, there were groups of Jews who didn't fight on Shabbos. So the enemy waited until Shabbos, they attacked them, and they defeated them. However, Matisyahu disagreed with that approach. And he said, "Let us fight against every man who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our brethren died in their hiding places." So Matisyahu becomes the leader, and Matisyahu engages in guerrilla warfare and eventually reduced Seleucid control in Judea and isolated Jerusalem from the army bases and the other administrative centers in Eretz Yisrael. After Matisyahu died, Judah HaMaccabee, Yehuda HaMaccabee, succeeded him, and the Seleucid Empire decided to take certain steps in order to maintain control over Yehuda HaMaccabee. Apollonius, the governor of Shomron, of Samaria, was sent to break through to Yerushalayim from the north with one of Antiochus' regular forces, but he failed and was killed in battle. A second general suffered the same fate. Two non-local commanders were also sent by the Syrian governor Ptolemy to approach Yerushalayim from the west, and they were also defeated. And Lysias, Antiochus' lieutenant, realized that the conditions in Eretz Yisrael were deteriorating, so he assembled a huge force to approach Yehuda HaMaccabee from the south through the lands of the Idumeans. But in a battle near Betzur on the border between Judea and Idumea, again, the Jews defeated him. And Yehuda HaMaccabee now took Yerushalayim itself, and essentially in 164 BCE, following the death of Antiochus, Yehuda HaMaccabee took control of Yerushalayim, and essentially the Beis HaMikdash, Yehuda HaMaccabee defeated the foreign soldiers who were there, and the Beis HaMikdash was purified, and the pagan cult there was abolished, and the service of the Beis HaMikdash was entrusted to the Kohanim of the Hashmonaim, even though Yehuda himself did not assume the role of Kohen Gadol himself. In memory of this victory, we celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah. Now, what's interesting is that in the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, when it describes the holiday of Hanukkah, it describes it as a miracle of lights, that when we defeated the kingdom of the Yevanim, the Greeks, so that we defeated them, we came in, we only found enough oil to last for one night, and it lasted eight nights. That's how our Gemara describes what happened. There's an interesting perspective that's found in the second book of Maccabees in chapter 10, from verses 5 to 10. And there in this passage, there's a reference of Vayachogu Chag LaShem Shmonas Yamim. They celebrated the holiday of this holiday, which was on the 25th day of Kislev, for 8 days. Kimei Chag HaSukkos, like the days of the Sukkos holiday. Because they remembered how they weren't able to celebrate the holiday of Sukkos in the Beis HaMikdash, but they were only able to celebrate the holiday of Sukkos in the mountains and in the caves. But now that they came back, so they were able to celebrate it in the Beis HaMikdash. And Vayichu Arve Nachal V'Kapos Tamarim V'Yashiru Shir Shech V'Da LaHashem. And they brought some of the Arba Minim, the Arve Nachal and the Kapos Tamarim, the Aravos and the Lulavim, and in celebration of this holiday. So there seems to be this connection that has been suggested between the holiday of Chanukah and the holiday of Sukkos, both being 8 days, obviously if you include Shmini Atzeres. We know that Beis Shammai is of the opinion that we go down from 8 to 1. We start with 8 lights on the first night. We go down to 7 on the second night, 6 on the third night. We don't follow Beis Shammai. We follow Beis Hillel. We go, start with 1 and we go up 2, 3, 4, 5 as in succeeding nights. But according to Beis Shammai, we go down from 8 to 1. Why? And Gemara says, Keneged Pare Achag, it corresponds to the sacrifices going down in order of sacrifices that we offered during the holiday of Sukkos. So there's a connection between Sukkos and Chanukah. Also, the Simchat Beit HaShoeva was lit up with torches. The Simchat Beit HaShoeva in Yerushalayim was at night, and the whole Yerushalayim was lit up with torches. And there's a lot of light going on in the holiday of Chanukah. Additionally, there's a mitzvah of publicizing the miracle for Chanukah. And explicit in the Torah, we're supposed to sit in Sukkos. Why? L'man yedi doroseichem, so that generation to know. There's also an element of publicizing the miracle. There's also a connection between the hider mitzvah, enhancing the mitzvah of Sukkos, of pri etz hadar, of beautiful fruit, and mahadrim mina mahadrim, enhancing the mitzvah of Chanukah. And additionally, we rededicated the Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, now during the holiday of Chanukah. And Sukkos, of course, is the day, according to the Vilna Gaon, when Hashem commanded us to initially build the Mishkan. So there might be some connection between the holiday of Chanukah and the holiday of Sukkos.